This is the University of Otago.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to tonight's public health lecture. Clearly, we have some very keen people in the audience to come out on a night like this, when you could have been sitting in front of your fire, if you're allowed one, keeping warm, rather than braving the weather. For people who don't know me, I'm Peter Joyce. I'm Dean of the University of Otago Christchurch. And it's my pleasure to chair the series of public lectures that we do. This year, as last year, all of these public lectures are also inaugural professorial lectures, which is a long tradition in the university for when people are newly appointed as professors, that they have to do the inaugural lecture. Now, Marguerite Vissers did her first science degree through the University of Canterbury and came on to University of Otago Christchurch to do her master's and PhD. She's been on staff for quite a number of years, and I'm sure she would prefer I don't say how many years she's been employed here. In 2013, she was promoted to professor in recognition of her research over many years here. I think a key person in Marguerite's development has been Professor Christine Winterbourne, who supervised her PhD and has been a colleague over many years. So I'll now hand over to Marguerite to deliver tonight's secret lecture about life's secrets. Marguerite.
Thanks very much, Peter. And it's not going to be a secret much longer. First of all, I'd just like to thank all of you for coming out tonight. I'm working on the assumption that everyone in this room is here because they absolutely want to be here. And so I feel privileged to be able to spend the next wee while telling you something about my work and the things that I'm interested in, and hopefully that you'll be interested in too. When I was looking at starting this talk, I was thinking there's a story I want to tell, and so I really need to start at the beginning. And I did have trouble finding a schoolgirl photo of myself in my impeccable filing system at home. This was the only one I could lay my hands on, and it's of me in about year seven, when I was about 12, or maybe 11 or 12, and believe me, this is a dress-up. We didn't normally go to school looking like this, so this was a dress-up occasion. But the reason I want to start with a school photo is that when I was at school and at high school, I had a dream of becoming a scientist. And I remember thinking when I was at secondary school, would it be possible to do science as a career? And would you be able to do this as a job? Because this would be amazing. And so I'm here today to tell you that that dream came true for me. And it's seen me through to more wonderful things. And so at the end of X number of years, you get to do great things like this. So now I still get to dress up, but I get to dress up in things that I'm publicising wonderful work. So I made a dress out of a poster from our students' work. So, but this is a story that of the things that excite and keep us going in the very difficult world of science. So when you're a research scientist, it's great fun. So you get to play with some amazing toys. So we have wonderful machines that can do fantastic things. They're also fantastic people to work with, and sometimes we get to dress up. But what we think about, where all the action is, really is up here. And what we think about is we're trying to understand the cause of disease. And so you can think about it like this. So what we do, what you might do is you might go to the doctor and you say, I'm feeling terrible. And he'll say, you've got cirrhosis of the liver. Well, we ask, why have you got cirrhosis of the liver? What's going on with these cells? What is cirrhosis of the liver? And not only what's going on in the whole liver, but each one of those cells has a whole intricate machinery. And so we want to know, what is it in that cell that's making your liver sick? And not only in the machinery of the cell, but right down to the protein level. So each one of those cells, you become sick because something goes wrong with the proteins in the cells in your body. And we're trying to understand the link between that and the clinic. So we're trying to make sense of the illness so that we can provide better insight into treatments and behaviours. So in telling you this story, I've got a number of topics I want to range through, and I thought it's a little bit difficult conceptually, so I'm going to take you on a tour through my virtual house. And so we're going to visit a number of rooms. And in the first room, I share the first room with these characters here. So these are my long-standing colleagues in the Centre for Free Radical Research, Christine Winterbourne, Tony Kettle, and Mark Hampton. And we've been working together for a long time, and it's a wonderful working partnership. But in this room, there are two other people. One of them has arthritis, and one has pneumonia. And so this is to illustrate that this is the topic of our research. So we broadly cover the reasons why this person gets arthritis and why this person gets pneumonia. And both of these conditions are a result of inflammation, either chronic or acute. And if you were to look, I want you to remember this picture of a lung with pneumonia. So in a normal healthy lung, you've got lots of open airways. And in a pneumonia lung, you've got a blocked part. So in this part, the air can't get in. And so this is what you might see on an X-ray. But we would ask, what's going on there? And that brings us to the cell of interest, which in this case is the neutrophil, which is one of our white blood cells. And probably it makes up half of our circulating white blood cells. And it's the first cell to respond in an infection. And so these cells circulate in your bloodstream. You can see them here. This is a section through our blood vessel. And they often sit on the side of the blood vessel because most of the infections and inflammation happens in your tissues, not in your blood. So these cells have got to get out. And they hear, they receive signals when there's something wrong in the tissues, and they migrate through the tissues and then through the wall of the blood vessel and into the tissues, and that's where they carry out their business. And their business is this. So fundamentally, these cells are our bacterial and pathogen killers. They're the first responders to infection, and they do this. Here's a picture of one cell here engulfing a bacterium. They do this by literally swallowing that bacterium and killing it inside themselves. Now, this process has been known for quite a long time, a very long time, in fact, and it was this man, Ilya Mechnikov, who first saw this phenomenon happening down the microscope, and he called it phagocytosis. And he saw it happening in a starfish larvae, and realised that this process is common across most organisms. And so if we look at a cartoon diagram of that, so this is a slice through a neutrophil. The process that happens is that the bacterium gets taken up. And when it's inside, it's enclosed in the particle. So it's completely removed from the outside of the cell and the inside of the neutrophil. And the neutrophil's full of these things called granules that contain toxic enzymes and things that can kill bacteria. The neutrophil empties that into that compartment, kills the bug, and then digests it up into all its component parts. And so it recycles the bad things in your body into things you can use, so the good things. So the ultimate, nature's the ultimate recycler. So our interest in the neutrophil is, how does it contribute to those disease states? So what does it do in the acute inflammation, and what does it do in the chronic inflammation? Because it's intimately involved in both. One of the things that neutrophils make in abundance is this compound here. Now, everyone will recognise that as a very common household antibacterial agent. So you use it to get rid of bacteria in your house because it will kill most things. And in the neutrophil uses it because the neutrophil needs to kill most bugs that it comes in contact with. So it's very good at doing that. What does that mean for disease? Well, for the pneumonia patient, that's good news because it will kill the bacterium in the pneumonia. In the arthritis patient, that's bad news. And the reason it's bad news is that here, in the arthritis patient, the neutrophil is directing its oxidants not at a bug, but at your knee or your back or any other autoimmune, and any other autoimmune disease, it's directing those oxidants at you. And therefore, this is one of the main causes of damage. So this area of research has been one of our major interests for quite a number of years, and there's still a lot to learn, but we have learned a lot about the production of Ginola by these cells. And so here's an example of some of the work we're currently doing with this. This is Stephanie Bozinet, who's been working at looking at how these oxidants affect the walls of our blood vessels. So in the case of atherosclerosis, the cells that line the walls of our blood vessels, there's a normal tissue here, and you can see that these cells here are looking pretty knackered. So we're looking at the way that these oxidants cause damage and what we can do to prevent it, if anything. And that brings me to the main topic of my talk, which is vitamin C and the role that it plays in conjunction with all of these mechanisms. So it was because we were interested in neutrophil oxidants that we started looking at vitamin C, because it's an antioxidant. And in the process of doing that, we've discovered that there are a whole lot of other activities of vitamin C that have impact in almost every aspect of our lives. This has kind of dragged me off in another research direction, but one that I think is very fruitful and very important. So everyone thinks they know everything about vitamin C. We all know we need it. That's about as much as actually all we know. We know we need it. We're trying to figure out why. Well, vitamin C is this small molecule. It's made from sugar. And it's made by plants and in the livers of most animals. So most animals don't need to eat anything with vitamin C in it. People, on the other hand, and other primates, guinea pigs, and some fruit bats can't make their own vitamin C. So somewhere in our evolutionary history, we've lost that ability to do that. So we must get it from our diet. So therefore, for us, it's a vitamin. So our interest in the neutrophil led us to think about, okay, here's a cell that makes a lot of oxidants. It also, if we look at where vitamin C is in our bodies, we take it in from our food, it gets distributed around our body and it gets taken up into our tissues at various levels. And the thought is that the level that your body accumulates it at is indicative of how essential it is to that organ. For example, it's really high in the adrenals, pituitary, and retina. It's also high in the brain, white blood cells, pancreas, liver, lymph, and also it's relatively high, but the lowest body stores are in skeletal and heart muscle. So people have, ever since we've known about vitamin C and they've looked at this distribution, think, what is it doing in all of these tissues? And so we asked this question around white blood cells, which is the thing that we're interested in. And it's been a process of discovery and theorising, And what I'm going to do is just take you to our findings. And they centre around the effect of vitamin C on neutrophil function. So these are the cells that engulf and kill bacteria. And if you remember back to that X-ray of the person with pneumonia, then this is what's happening. So this is a microscope view of the lung. So this is a normal lung here, which has got nice big air space, which is what you need when you take a deep breath. When you get an infection, so this is after 8 hours, you see that those air spaces getting filled up. Well, there, what's filling those up are these white cells, the neutrophils. And after 2 days, the air space is full. So that whiteness that you saw on that X-ray is this. It's full of all these neutrophils. Now, what we need for recovery of that is these. We've got to get rid of these cells. They might have killed off the bacteria, but we now have to get rid of the neutrophil. And how does that happen in our body? So we need to get back from there to there in order to restore good lung function. And we need to do it in a way that doesn't destroy the lung along the way. Now, I said these cells are really good at causing tissue injury, and they're really good at killing bacteria, and they are loaded with proteases and enzymes that can cause havoc if they end up in your body. So we have this whole mechanism of containment of the system, and we need to, that needs to work in order to get from here to here. So what we need after the inflammation is an effective cleanup, and it's in this aspect that we're interested in vitamin C. Now, normally, this is what happens to dying neutrophils. So at the end of that infection, when they undergo a kind of a cell, what we call a cell suicide or apoptosis. And you see here in this cartoon, this is a normal neutrophil, and here it is on the way to cell death. And you can see it's kind of wrinkly outside and all of these little vesicles. And you see these green signals on the cell. Well, these are sending out a message to another cell called a macrophage. And they're saying to that macrophage, come eat me. And so the macrophage is the cleanup cell. It comes into that inflammatory site after the wave of neutrophils, and they clean up. And so here's a picture here of an actual neutrophil, and here you can see the electron micrograph of it underway in that process, and you can see all of that blebbing. Now, we've spent a bit of time looking at this, and we've been able to use one of our very cool new toys, which is a time-lapse microscope. And so I've been making some movies of that process in action. And hopefully this will play, and I can show them to you now. So what you see here, I'll use the mouse to point. This is a mixture of neutrophils. These are normal neutrophils, and they all contain vitamin C. And they've just been left in a dish, and they're going to undergo that cell death process. And I'll point them out as they start to ruffle and bleb. You'll see them. This short video covers a period of about 5 hours. So, you know, it's time lapse. So we see it here. Here goes the first one, there. I think this one's next, there. There's another one down here that, there he goes. See him go? There's another one here. I think that one, or this one up here, is going to go next. That one's gone. There he goes. So one at a time. So one just coming into frame. There he is. So you can see they're normally moving around. They undergo the cell death, and then they stop moving. So, and they do it. You know, they're on a program towards doing this. And those cells, at the end of that process, or during that process, they're supposed to be sending these signals to the macrophage. Now, from these same preparations, we've also got a preparation of macrophages. And so what I've done is I've taken those dying neutrophils and I've added them to this plate here. And these cells that you see here, these are macrophages. They're all stuck on the bottom. I want you to concentrate on this guy here. He's amazing. So I'm going to show you what happens when we put these dying neutrophils onto this cell. And remembering that diagram, what you're going to see is you're going to see the cell eating the cells in the vicinity. And so there he goes. You watch him go. So you can see inside the cell, you can actually see the shape of the cells it's taking up. So they're mostly kind of ghostly, the dying cells, but he's hunting and looking for, you'll see him pick up, cells from this vicinity here. So, and then he goes off and hunts up in this direction for a while. And you can see other cells around doing very similar things. So this process starts up as soon as we add those dying neutrophils to that mixture. They're amazing. I think I sat there for about 4 hours looking at it. I don't know how many cells they can eat, but it looks like an awful lot. And so inside that, they're recycling all of that material that they're taking up. And this is what's happening in your bodies pretty much on a daily basis. So we wonder what happens if you have a vitamin C deficient neutrophil. So if the cells don't have vitamin C, how does this affect that cell death process? And so these are vitamin C deficient cells, and they're at the same age as those first ones you saw that are all that bubble and boil, so to speak. And so what you see here, if you watch this one here, these cells don't do that. There's an awful lot of activity inside that cell, but there's no blebbing or bubbling, and in fact, they pop. So, and at the end of our time, so you watch this one here, it's kind of halfway through this process, they start, instead of shrinking up, they start to swell up, and then they form, you get these kind of balloon cells. And at the end of the process, we've got a whole lot of these cells that look dead. But so what happens to them if you put them with the macrophages? What would happen to them? And so here we have another lot of macrophages, and these are, so here we are up close. And so if you concentrate in this area here, there's two candidates that look very similar to our previous one. And you'll see that I've added those dying vitamin C deficient neutrophils to these. And you can see that these cells, they're definitely alive, they're sitting there, but there's no activity with respect to recognizing those dead and dying vitamin C deficient neutrophils. So these cells are blind to that signal. And what that means for people is that we need good vitamin C when we're sick. We need good vitamin C for our immune cells in order for that cleanup to happen in a controlled way. And as we were thinking about this, and here's a summary of this part of the talk, we were thinking, so vitamin C is required for effective neutrophil removal and cleanup. And actually, what would happen if this went wrong? And so we thought, do we have any clinical evidence that would be devastating? Because someone asked me a question in one of our research groups once, and they said, what would happen? And I said, you would dissolve from the inside. And then we thought, what happens to people with scurvy? And actually, here's an example of someone with scurvy. Your tissues break down from the inside. So, we think it's very possible that one of the major contributors to this kind of damage is the fact that your neutrophils are bursting and releasing those enzymes into your tissues in a way that's actually devastating. And as a result of that, you know, people with scurvy die sudden and horrible deaths. So it was in thinking about this and this aspect of our work that we thought, well, this is true in neutrophils, which have vitamin C, but how's the vitamin C doing this? What's the mechanism behind this? And we started looking at other kinds of neutrophil functions. And one of the papers that came out around the time that we were thinking about this showed us that that a lack of oxygen, so if neutrophils are active in a lack of oxygen, they have plenty of vitamin C, they behave almost identically to our neutrophils that have no vitamin C, even though ours have got plenty of oxygen. And so we started thinking, you know, what's the link here? Because what the cells are doing is exactly the same thing. And are these two things linked in some way? Sorry, I need to go back to that. Because this is Usha Pujari, who's a PhD student. She's now studying the effect of hypoxia or low oxygen on neutrophil function. Turning out some very nice data too. Now the link, taking you back then to we look at proteins inside cells, the link is a protein called HIF1, hypoxia inducible factor, or HIF. And this protein controls the cell's response to low oxygen under normal conditions. So every cell in your body has it, and it's a stress response protein that will react in the absence of oxygen. So, and it does that in this way. So the protein's made up of two components, alpha and beta, and the alpha component gets modified by these enzymes called prolyl hydroxylases and others, a few others. And these enzymes stick these hydroxyl groups on that protein, and that means it gets destroyed. So this is an off switch. And these enzymes need oxygen and vitamin C. So this is the link. This is the link between vitamin C and the white blood cell functions. So if oxygen or vitamin C is missing, then what you have is this protein is stabilized, so it stays in the cell, and it is able to pair up with its sister protein, and that upregulates a whole lot of gene responses that means that cells can overcome the stress of low oxygen. So no ascorbate or no oxygen will do the same thing. And when we were looking at HIF1, we realised that not only is it likely to have an effect in our white cells, because one of the things that it regulates is how cells grow and die, and we see an effect on how those white cells die. But it's responsible for a whole raft of other responses in the cell, including a whole lot of things that we know to be common to cancer and many other stress responses. So a lack of oxygen, for example, will mean that the cell switches its energy pathways to get its energy in a non-oxygen dependent way, or that it stimulates the formation of new blood vessels to bring new oxygen to the region that's lacking it. And so we started thinking about HIF1 not just in terms of the white blood cell, but in terms of all our cells and what it might be doing there. And so we're going to leave the first room in my virtual house, and we're going to the second room, which I share with these people. This is Gabby Dax and Margaret Curry and Helen Morin from the McKenzie Cancer Research Group, and this is Caroline Cooper and Lizzie Campbell, who are two PhD students who are working on our topics. And in this room, we find people with cancer. And so it was our realisation that HIF1 is really important to cancer that made us consider, well, if vitamin C's involved in regulating HIF-1, maybe it has something to do with regulating cancer growth as well. And at this point, you have to take a brave step, because this is an area of huge controversy. And I've stayed with this idea because actually I think it's a good idea and there's something to it. But within probably in the last, well, since the 1980s, there's been two polarised groups fighting about whether or not vitamin C has anything to do with cancer or not. And earlier, and it all started really with this man here, Linus Pauling, who was the most amazing scientist and active individual as well, one of only two people to be individually sharing the Nobel Prize in different areas. So he and Marie Curie are the only two people to have achieved this. And Linus Pauling received the Nobel Prize in 1954 for uncovering how proteins maintain their shape. So the kind of forces that are involved in giving proteins their shape. And in 1962, he got the Nobel Peace Prize for his anti-war efforts in the United States. And it was shortly after this, actually it was in the 1970s, that he started working with a Dr. Cameron in Scotland, who was giving his patients intravenous vitamin C, giving his cancer patients intravenous vitamin C, and claiming that these people were seeing wonderful benefits. Well, at the time, there was no mechanism to explain why that would possibly be a good idea. And he got blasted pretty much by everybody for even suggesting that it was possible. Now, he wasn't a medic, and he waded into this area of research really without any, you know, kind of guns blazing, without any fear, as you would have, you wouldn't have if you had two Nobel Prizes, that any fear of criticism, but also there was never, in all of the efforts that he made, there was never a mechanism to explain why this might be a good idea. And so we were thinking about this and thought, you know, actually maybe Linus Pauling was onto something and maybe it needs a further look. So let's have a look at the HIF-1. And so and our hypothesis is based on the fact that HIF-1 is a major driver of tumour growth. So, and the reason it does this is because as a solid tumour starts to form in your body, the minute it gets beyond 1 or 2 millimetres big, it needs a blood supply, or else those cells have no oxygen, because oxygen won't diffuse further than that. And so what happens is that the centre of that tumour gets hypoxic. So as it runs out of oxygen, it turns on HIF-1 in the centre. And once it does that, it starts to generate new blood vessels that feed the tumour. And that the ability to do that allows the tumour to grow bigger and bigger. And this is what we call the tumour microenvironment. So it's this stress on these cells in the centre that allows that tumour to grow bigger. If we didn't have this, we probably wouldn't have solid tumours. They actually would be unable to grow without it. So knowing that vitamin C is involved in regulating HIF, we thought, is there any link between vitamin C in the tumour and the amount of HIF activation that we see? Because as you can imagine, vitamin C's got to get delivered in here as well. And so in the absence of blood vessels in this centre, then you're going to get more HIF upregulated if you have no oxygen and no vitamin C. So if you have one or the other, you'll moderate that effect. So we're not looking for an all or none. What we're looking for is let's shift that gradient so that we're damping down this response. And what effect does that have? Does that have any effect on the tumour growth? Because that might explain why people sometimes do better when they're seeing, when they're upping their vitamin C intake. And so I was very lucky at that time that Caroline Cooper walked through the door and said, I want to do a PhD project in cancer. And I said, I've got the perfect project for you. And Caroline has carried out an extremely difficult PhD and made a wonderful job of it. She's a fantastic student. Well, she was. She's now a postdoc. And what we did was we made use of a resource that's in this building. It's the Cancer Society Tissue Bank. And so over the years, people have donated their tissues, their tumour tissues, when they've been removed by surgery, and they've been banked here. And so we have an amazing resource that's tumour tissue and normal tissue from the same patient. And so we thought, let's analyse those tissues because we can measure what's going on in those tumours. And let's see what we can measure. So this is Caroline grinding up a tiny piece of tumour, which you can see in the vague pink here, under liquid nitrogen. So we keep everything cold to keep it stable. And she has measured in this tumour, the cells, the HIF1 proteins that it generates, and also vitamin C. So we've measured all of the things together in a patient, in their normal tissue and in the tumour tissue, to see, is there any difference? Are there any differences there? Well, wouldn't be telling you this if there weren't. So what we found was that in high-grade tumours, so those are tumours that have a poor blood supply or a disorganised blood supply, that the amount of vitamin C is much lower than it is in low-grade tumours. So these tumours have more difficulty getting hold of the vitamin C that they have. But when we look at the absolute amount, and that's dependent not only on the type of tumour, but also on how much vitamin C that person might be taking in or what their normal plasma levels are, then what we see is the amount of vitamin C in the tumour affects the amount of HIF1 that's activated in that tumour. So tumours that had higher ascorbate content had much damped down levels of that HIF1 protein. We would expect that would have a positive benefit on tumour growth. So it would slow down tumour growth. And tumours that had the lower half, they had much higher activation. Now, because many of these samples have been banked, some of them for up to 10 years, we were able to do a retrospective analysis on the tissues that we analysed to see how those patients had done post-surgery. And so this is a result from our colorectal cancer study. So at this point here, the tumour was removed surgically. And so the patient's been followed up along that time. And what you can see here is that those tumours that had higher levels of vitamin C at this point, those patients did better with a much lesser number of patients presenting with secondary cancers or progressing on than the tumours that had low vitamin C. Now, this is the first time that anyone's been able to do this analysis, and it's a fortunate coincidence of expertise and dedication. So we have dedicated people who have acquired this tissue, and also that combines with our expertise at being able to measure something in the tissue. So measurement is good. So this change, nothing to do with stage or grade of the tumour, was only dependent on how much vitamin C was in there. So we haven't manipulated this at all, but it's a good indication that what we might want to do is a clinical trial where we actually do an intervention so we can see if you give a patient more, is that likely to benefit? We're begging to do that work. So that's our hypothesis, that if we can have an impact on this region here, damp down that response, then that's going to slow the rate of tumour growth. And it will also help the rate of chemotherapy. So, vitamin C could be a useful adjunct to the current therapies that we have. So now I'm going to take you into my third room. Because it wasn't just, it's not just about cancer, it's about these proteins being present in all our cells all the time. And we know we need vitamin C on a daily basis, so we're thinking, you know, that might be really important in cancer, but how does these mechanisms impact on our general stress responses? And so in this room with me is Steph Bozanet, Anitrika, and Juliet Puller. And I'm really fortunate to be able to work with these three because they're a phenomenal team. And so in this room, in my virtual house, there's a lot of people. And in fact, everybody is in this room. So everybody in this room is in this room because this issue actually affects our day-to-day health and well-being. And I'm going to show you how we are trying to contend with some of those things. And so those enzymes that regulate HIF that I told you about, they're one of a family, or they're part of a family. And this family of enzymes is present in all our cells doing a multitude of jobs. They all have the same properties. They need oxygen, they need vitamin C to work. Some of them downregulate things, some of them upregulate things. And new functions are being discovered for them almost daily. So they were first known to help make collagen, so to make the modifications that allow good, strong collagen cross-linking in our tissues. So people tell you vitamin C is good for your skin. They're also known to be involved in the rate of hormone synthesis in the brain and the adrenals. These are the HIF enzymes that actually control metabolic responses, so good supply of oxygen, not just in tumours, but in all our tissues. They've recently been shown to be involved in epigenetics, which is the control of the way our cells, the kind of genes that are read in our cells, over and above your genetic inheritance. And they're also involved in cell stress signalling responses. So if we look at that myriad of functions, then you can see that the kinds of effects that might have on us is that vitamin C can be beneficial for wound healing, tissue formation, can be involved in mood and energy, is important in cancer, the immune system, and one of the enzymes that controls the situations of metabolism is like appetite control. In the epigenetics, they can regulate gene function, which can pretty much affect everything, and also our general stress responses to environmental stresses. So we get pretty excited at this point and think, my God, you know, this is fundamental to our health. And when we think about animals generally, they make their own vitamin C and they control their levels absolutely meticulously. So an animal that's making its own vitamin C will maintain that level no matter what. But we don't. We need to eat it. And so this is where, you know, in our modern world, we might be going amiss. And here, so this is often a question that people ask, how much vitamin C do we need? And this has been argued about since 1932 when this was discovered as the cause for scurvy, because the level that was recommended was the level that you need in order not to get scurvy. So it was thought, we don't want people to be having too much, let's just give them enough, you know, we just need to stop people having scurvy because that's what vitamin C does. Well, the RDA, or as it's set, this is a graph that shows you the amount of vitamin C in your blood. And this is where all of your tissues get it from. And so the more vitamin C you take in, the higher it goes in your blood. And you'll see, you know, you need to be up here in order to be for your blood levels to be saturated. But our RDA is way down here. So it's at 45 milligrams per day. This is what we are advised. This is what you need in order to survive and to be healthy. These are healthy levels. Well, Mark Levine, who did this work, points out that, you know, if you look at this curve here, this is a really steep part of the curve. If you alter your intake even slightly to either side of that, you could end up down here or up here. And so at this level, it's going to be huge variation in terms of how much you take up. And what he recommends is that actually, you know, 500 milligrams a day, 200 milligrams a day will get you up here. And that's much more like a healthy level. And interestingly, those are the levels at which you see prevention of chronic diseases. So when people are taking in, you know, 400 milligrams a day, that has an effect on longevity, cancer, heart disease. A whole number of big studies have shown that kind of intake has good health preventative measures. And so it's not only when you're well. So I said animals will maintain their levels no matter what, because their body's responding to the different environmental challenges. And so one of the things we're getting interested in is, you can see here there are white bars and black bars. Now the white bars are a healthy population. This is blood vitamin C levels, and this is the percent of people. And so if you look at the white bars first here, deficiency levels are anything below about 28 micromolar. So anything down from here. So even the healthy population, there's quite a few people who don't have a lot of circulating vitamin C. Now, they won't have scurvy symptoms, but how healthy are they likely to be? And actually, the peak of normal people, around about 50, which also isn't that saturation level, so it's not as much as your body can take on board. When you look at a population of hospital patients, so these are people on admission to hospital, these are sick people, their vitamin C levels are low, really low. This is the Canadian study. And most of them are down in the deficiency level. Now, I don't know if any of you have spent time in the wards in the hospital, but you'd be pushing it to get your daily vitamin C intake from a hospital diet. And I think it's probably why we bring fruit to hospital patients, so they should probably eat that. But this is interesting because animals, when they're sick, will increase their level of synthesis. So a goat, apparently, when it's sick, will make 70 grams a day of vitamin C in order to maintain its blood at those levels. Now, people have taken very little notice of this, and it's very hardly ever measured as a measure of patient well-being. But I guess what we're saying is, you know, and these people also in Canada are saying, is we need to look at this, because if you supplement these patients, you see a benefit in terms of outcome and mood. So there's some interesting work that's appearing. So just but for you and I, on our day-to-day basis, we want to get that 200 milligrams of vitamin C from our diet. Then how are we going to do that? And one of our aims is to look at how we're going to get this public health message out there that, one, the RDI should be increased, but secondly, you know, what kind of dietary advice do we give people? And currently, the kind of healthy eating is, you know, 5+ a day for fruit and vegetables, without any advice as to what fruit are better than what. Not all fruit and vegetables are equal when it comes to vitamin C. In fact, absolutely not. So you can see here, and I've got here, you know, one of our main exports, kiwi fruit, green and gold. You know, there's a few things that have been listed as exceptional, and this is an international website. And kiwi fruit's up there with two of them. Capsicum's also really good. And then as you go further down the list, you'll see, you know, we've got, you know, broccoli's coming in first in the vegetables. But if you were to, per serving, if you were to want to get 200 milligrams per day, then, and you're picking your 5+ a day out of here, if you're eating from down here, your 5+, you're not going to be taking in that much vitamin C. And so, you know, one of the messages we give you is that, well, that's all well and good, but one of those things should be something from the top of the list, because you want to increase your uptake, then you need to be eating, you know, right across the range. Cabbage is very good. So we did a study in conjunction with Zespri because they're interested because kiwi fruit scores so well on that graph. We've recruited some university students who anecdotally eat really badly. Turns out not many of them eat that badly, but it's not that hard to find people who have very low vitamin C. And so just to see what impact that has. So what you eat, how does that impact on your vitamin C intake? So this is number of serves of fruit and vegetables that these guys had. And so you can see when they came in, they're having around about four serves, and most people would say that's not bad. And then we've supplemented them with either half a kiwi fruit, one, two, or three kiwi fruit. By the time they're eating two and three kiwi fruit, their number of serves of fruit and vegetables has gone up, so that the kiwi fruit's having an impact on their total intake. But when we compare that graph with the amount of vitamin C they're getting from their food, so their initial intake has got them right here at the RDI level of 50 milligrams, just under 50 milligrams. Health department would say, that's fine, you're doing great. When they add kiwi fruit, half a kiwi fruit makes a difference to that. One, two, three kiwi fruit gets them up to 300 milligrams a day. So two kiwi fruits, adding a high-value food like that. So if you were to have an orange or, you know, something from the top of the list, that's going to boost your intake if you want to stay with five plus a day. When we looked in the blood of these young men, you see that 45 milligrams that they started with, that doesn't do their plasma vitamin C much good. So actually, they're, you know, just above the or around about the early deficiency level. When we give them the kiwi fruit within a week, two kiwi fruit, they're up to saturating levels. So they've been able, their body's been able to take that up, and it responds immediately to your uptake. So vitamin C is water soluble, and so easily taken up. At the end of the intervention, we take them, they stop eating the kiwi fruit, and look what happens, you know, back to their old habits. And within a few weeks, their bodies deplete again. So the message is daily, not just once a month. Once a month won't help. And this is their tissue levels, so not only is it in their blood, but it also makes a difference to your tissue. So this is their muscle vitamin C levels, and you can see that the higher their blood vitamin C goes, the higher their muscle levels are. And that will be reflective of all their other tissues as well. So, you know, if you're surviving down here at the 20, then, you know, all of your tissues are going to be depleted, which is something that we hadn't thought would happen. We thought the tissues would, you know, take it up much more readily and hold on to it for longer. But no, they don't. So, you know, animals make this on a daily basis, and we probably need to eat it on a daily basis. And so we've looked at, as part of that study, and one of the interesting things that came out of it was that we did a mood questionnaire on these young men before and after eating the kiwi fruit. Now, they weren't depressed, but when we analysed the score, so they're not clinically depressed, when we analyse their scores, you can see that after the kiwi fruit, there's a significant decrease in what we call the total mood disturbance score. And that number is made up of a number of different measures. And where that difference is, this is a combined measure of all of these things, where that difference has come about is that the vitamin C intervention, when we believe that's what the kiwi fruit's contributing, is a drop in the rate of depression in these young men and a decrease in fatigue, so they felt like they had more energy, and an increase in vigour, so which is another measure. So these are measures of well-being. And this is really interesting because this population would be representative of, you know, you and I and people who think, you know, you think you're well, but actually you can be weller. And so this is Mark Levine again, and his message is the same, is that, you know, if you're looking at vitamin C in the plasma, then you want to, if, you know, at these kind of levels, you're going to rapidly rising at 100% protection from getting scurvy. But if you want to see other health benefits, then that's a much slower improvement, and it's really not until you get to these saturating levels in your plasma, so where your blood's got as much as your body wants it to have, that you're going to see the maximum health benefit, so in terms of health and well-being. So I'm going to end our story there and tell you that we're still going, and we're emerging with our dreams intact. So there are still things we want to do. We want to continue to look at how vitamin C supports immune cell function, and we have some studies underway for that. We want to do a proper informed clinical study with vitamin C in cancer. And I think, you know, people are screaming for this to be done, and we would love to be able to do it. And fingers crossed, we may be getting closer to that. We would also like to be able to influence the RDI level within New Zealand and Australia. So it's an Australasian measure. In the US, in fact, Anitra was instrumental in having the US level doubled up to 100 milligrams. And we would like to see the New Zealand health system take a similar message, that actually we need to be telling people that, you know, what they think is enough is actually not enough. And so it remains for me to thank people. Many of you will know, but we survive on grant funding, and so that pays our salaries and working expenses, as well as the support that we get from the university. And so applying for funding is a major part of our activities, and we're very grateful to all these funding bodies for supporting us over the years. So I think I'm very fortunate to have been able to do science in a period when I started that funding was ample compared with today. We didn't think so at the time, but we didn't spend 90% of our time applying for money, whereas now, you know, many people spend far too much time applying for money and not being allowed to get on with doing. That's something that we continue to try to influence, but I thought, can't let him, you know, we can't give a talk and not say that things in this country are difficult at best for people doing biomedical research or medical research generally. So we've managed to get some money from the Ministry, the MBIE. ZESPRI has been a wonderful organisation to work with, and they're very real, and also they understand science as well. The CMRF, which is a local funding organisation, very important organisation for keeping us going at times when we otherwise would have faltered. The Lottery Grants Board provides some funding for materials and equipment, and TEC, which I'll mention, it doesn't do this anymore, but it supported Caroline's PhD scholarship, and it's a shame that they stopped doing that, because, you know, we never had funding for that cancer study, and if it hadn't been for the fact that she'd walked in to do it, you know, we would have struggled to do that. So it was wonderful to have a fantastic student who was able to be supported to do that work. So I have two thank yous to make. One, well, that was the first one of three. One is, the second one is thank you to the Centre for Free Radical Research. This is our current grouping. I think we've had, I don't know how many group photos we've had with umpteen people, but we have a group, as you can see, of wonderful young students and postdocs who come in to work with us and to keep us vibrant and interested. And I'd like to say that, you know, I feel really fortunate to have been worked through the time that I did when my education was free, my PhD study was subsidised, and I was able to establish myself in a research career at a time when funding was relatively abundant compared with today. These students have equal passion, but much less opportunity. It is much harder for them. And I'm full of admiration to them for choosing science as a pathway, and also for having the courage to stay there with it. Many of them go on, we lose most of them overseas when they finish their PhDs. They do very well in overseas laboratories because they're very good. We need to keep some of them in New Zealand. And so let's hope that we can make some progress in that area. And the last thank you is to my other team and my other support crew. And they're nearly all here. Maria's in London, so she'll be watching online sometime in the future. So without this lot, I wouldn't be standing here today. And they continue to be my inspiration and drive. And they pick me up every time I come home and say, I don't know if I can do this anymore. It's all too hard. So I get the word put on me from these three, you need to inspire us, because they've chosen very difficult careers as well. So my husband's an artist and they've all inherited the art gene. And so it came through me, but not from me. Olivia's an artist, Heather's a musician, and Maria's an actor. And I'm grateful to have young people like this in my life who are willing to embrace that challenge and say, this is our talent. We value what we can do well, and we want to contribute to the world with it. And so with the young people in our group, so I want to dedicate this to the young people in our group and to these young people who are prepared to take a chance on their lives. And so I want to finish with just one word from a card that Olivia just gave me before I came in here. And she says, hooray for science, art, music, knowledge. And I'd like to finish with that. Amen, I say.